A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about personal philosophy. Not the kind you find in textbooks, but the one every person carries around in their head. The working theory of how the world operates, what matters, what doesn't. He wants to know if anyone's actually studied how people build these belief systems. Whether the process differs between religious and atheist people. How much is culture versus direct life experience, and whether our philosophies stay stable or go through periods of intense flux. It's basically four questions wrapped in one. Where do we even start?
I'd start with what the research actually says, because there's a surprising amount of it. The field that tackles this most directly is called personal epistemology. It's the study of how individuals develop their beliefs about knowledge, truth, and how the world works. And the name that comes up over and over is Barbara Hofer. She's a psychologist at Middlebury who basically mapped out how personal epistemologies develop from childhood through adulthood.
So it's the philosophy of how you get your philosophy.
That's actually not a bad way to put it. Hofer's framework identified several dimensions. Things like how certain someone believes knowledge is, whether they see truth as handed down by authorities or constructed through evidence, and how they handle conflicting claims. What's interesting is that these dimensions don't all develop at the same pace. Someone might be sophisticated about evaluating scientific claims, but still treat political information as something you just absorb from trusted sources.
Which explains about 80% of Thanksgiving dinner arguments.
And Hofer's work built on earlier research by William Perry, who studied Harvard undergraduates back in the 1950s and 60s. Perry found that students typically move through a sequence, starting from a dualistic view where everything is right or wrong and authorities have the answers, through a period of multiplism where all opinions seem equally valid, and eventually toward what he called commitment within relativism, where you recognize that knowledge is contextual, but you still make reasoned commitments.
The arc is someone tells you the truth, then nobody knows the truth, then you pick your truth knowing it's a choice.
That's the developmental arc Perry described, though later researchers have complicated it considerably. The big critique is that Perry only studied elite male college students. When researchers looked at women, at different cultures, at people who didn't go to college, the trajectories looked different.
Of course they did. The universal theory built on Harvard men, a tale as old as psychology.
And that's actually relevant to the second part of the prompt, the religious versus atheist distinction. There's a researcher named Jonathan Haidt who's done extensive work on moral foundations and how they differ across political and religious lines. His moral foundations theory identified something like six basic moral intuitions: care, fairness, liberty, loyalty, authority, and sanctity. What he found is that religious people tend to draw on all six roughly equally, while secular people tend to weight care and fairness much more heavily and the others less.
The religious mind has more moral dials to turn.
More dials, and they're calibrated differently. But here's the part I find fascinating. Haidt argues that these moral intuitions come first, and the reasoning comes second. We have a gut feeling that something is wrong, and then we construct an argument for why. He calls it the rational rider on the emotional elephant.
Which would mean we don't reason our way to a philosophy. We philosophize our way to justifying what we already felt.
That's the strong version of his claim, and it's controversial. But there's good evidence for it. When researchers put people in fMRI scanners and present them with moral dilemmas, the emotional centers light up before the reasoning centers. The justification is post hoc.
If I'm understanding this, and tell me if I'm oversimplifying, the religious person and the atheist aren't just arriving at different conclusions from the same process. They might be running different processes entirely.
That's the implication, and it's backed up by some fascinating cross-cultural work. There was a large study published in Science, I think it was 2019 or so, that looked at how people across something like 20 different societies reason about moral dilemmas. They found that the distinction isn't just religious versus secular, it's also about the kind of religious thinking. People from societies with big gods, Moralizing deities who punish transgressions tend to think about fairness towards strangers differently than people from societies with more local, less moralizing spiritual traditions.
As opposed to the boutique deities.
The term is actually used in the academic literature. Big gods versus small gods. Small gods are concerned with their own worship, not with whether you're nice to your neighbor. Big gods are moral enforcers. And the emergence of big gods correlates with the emergence of large-scale societies where you need to cooperate with strangers.
The philosophy might be downstream of the social structure, which is downstream of the theology.
Or they co-evolve. That's the chicken and egg problem. But let me bring this back to the third question, culture versus direct experience. There's been a lot of work on this in cultural psychology. The big name is Richard Schwieder, who argued that culture and psyche make each other up. You can't separate them. But more recent work has tried to tease apart the relative contributions.
How do you even study that?
One approach is to look at immigrants. If someone moves from a collectivist culture to an individualist one at age 5 versus age 25, how does their worldview differ? There's been work showing that the age of migration matters enormously for things like attribution style, whether you explain behavior in terms of personality traits or situational factors. People who migrate as children tend to adopt the attribution style of the new culture. People who migrate as adults tend to retain the style of their origin culture, even decades later.
There's a window. A formative period where the cultural operating system gets installed, and after that you're running patches, not a full replacement.
That's the sensitive period hypothesis, and it shows up in a lot of domains. Language, obviously, but also moral reasoning, aesthetic preferences, even things like how you perceive optical illusions. The Muller-Lyer illusion, where lines with arrows pointing different directions appear to be different lengths. People from Western cultures are much more susceptible to it than people from some non-Western cultures. But here's the twist. If you test people who grew up in those non-Western cultures but now live in cities with lots of rectilinear architecture, they start to see the illusion more.
Because buildings train their visual system.
The environment is literally reshaping perception. And if that's true for something as low-level as visual processing, imagine what it does to something as complex as your philosophy of life.
We've got developmental trajectories, moral intuitions that precede reasoning, cultural operating systems installed during sensitive periods. What about the fourth question? Stability versus flux. Does your philosophy stay put once it's formed?
This is where the lifespan development literature gets really interesting. There's a researcher named Ursula Staudinger who's done work on what she calls wisdom, which she defines as a combination of deep insight, good judgment, and the ability to handle the fundamental pragmatics of life. And she finds something counterintuitive. Wisdom doesn't necessarily increase with age. What increases is what she calls wisdom-related knowledge, the raw material. But the actual integration of that knowledge into a coherent philosophy? That seems to peak in middle adulthood and then sometimes declines. But the pattern isn't linear, and it's highly individual.
The cliché of the wise elder is only half true. You accumulate material, but you might not get better at weaving it together.
And then there's the work on what psychologists call narrative identity. Dan McAdams at Northwestern has spent decades studying how people construct their life stories, and he argues that our personal philosophy is embedded in the story we tell about ourselves. That story gets revised, but certain themes tend to persist. He identified a dimension called agency versus communion. Whether your story emphasizes personal achievement or connection with others, that shows remarkable stability over time.
That's the theme, not the details.
The plot points change. New chapters get added, old ones get reinterpreted. But the narrative arc, the underlying philosophy of what makes a life meaningful, that's surprisingly stable. Unless something disrupts it.
Which brings us to the periods of flux.
The literature on this points to a few predictable inflection points. Late adolescence and emerging adulthood is the big one. That's when people are actively constructing their worldview, often in opposition to their parents' worldview. Then there's what some researchers call the midlife review. Not necessarily a crisis, but a period of reassessment in the 40s and 50s when people start thinking about legacy and what they've built.
Then there's the unplanned ones.
That's where the most dramatic philosophical shifts happen. Trauma, loss, major life transitions. These are what researchers call epistemically destabilizing events. They shake your confidence in what you thought you knew. There's a concept from Jack Mesereau called transformative learning. It's when an experience is so disorienting that it forces you to critically examine your fundamental assumptions and rebuild your meaning framework from scratch.
The philosophy equivalent of burning down the house and rebuilding.
It's not always a clean rebuild. Some people get stuck in what researchers call moratorium, a prolonged state of exploration without commitment. Others foreclose early. They adopt a philosophy without really examining it, often from parents or a dominant cultural narrative, and then defend it rigidly because examining it would be too threatening.
That's the person who has a quote for every occasion, and none of them are original.
That's the foreclosure pattern, and it's actually associated with certain personality profiles, higher need for closure, lower openness to experience. There's a researcher named Ari Kruglansky who's done extensive work on need for closure, and he finds that it predicts all sorts of things. Political conservatism, certainly, but also how people process information, how they respond to ambiguity, even how they form impressions of other people.
Let me push on that a bit. You said need for closure predicts political conservatism. But that's one of those findings that makes me wonder about the direction of the arrow. Maybe the philosophy shapes the cognitive style rather than the other way around.
That's a fair question, and the research actually suggests it's bidirectional. There's some evidence that need for closure has a heritable component. Twin studies suggest something like 40% heritability. But it's also shaped by environment. Living in an unstable, unpredictable environment tends to increase need for closure. There's work showing that people who grew up in economic insecurity tend to score higher on it.
Which would mean the philosophy is partly an adaptation to the environment you found yourself in.
That's the argument. And it connects to something Haidt has written about. The idea that moral and political philosophies aren't just abstract belief systems. They're solutions to the problem of how to organize social life given particular constraints. If you live in a world where resources are scarce and threats are high, a philosophy that emphasizes in-group loyalty, respect for authority, and purity makes adaptive sense.
The philosophy as survival strategy.
Or at least as a strategy that made sense in the environment where it evolved. Whether it still makes sense in the current environment is a separate question. But this is where the religious-atheist distinction gets really interesting, because religious communities often provide what researchers call cultural scaffolding for maintaining a particular philosophy.
Explain cultural scaffolding.
It's the set of practices, rituals, social norms, and institutions that reinforce a worldview. Weekly religious services where you hear the same themes, rituals that mark life transitions. A community that shares your assumptions and doesn't challenge them. This scaffolding is incredibly powerful. It's one reason religious belief tends to be more stable over the lifespan than non-religious belief. The scaffolding holds it in place.
Whereas the atheist is doing their own drywall.
More or less. Without the institutional scaffolding, secular philosophies require more active maintenance. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It can mean more thoughtful, examined beliefs. But it also means more vulnerability to drift and destabilization.
This connects back to something you mentioned earlier about Hofer's work on personal epistemology. Do religious and secular people differ in how they think about knowledge itself?
And there's actually research on this. Studies using Hofer's epistemological framework have found some differences. Religious individuals tend to score higher on the dimension of omniscient authority, the belief that truth is handed down by a supreme authority. But here's the nuance. They don't necessarily score lower on other dimensions of epistemological sophistication. You can believe that ultimate truth comes from divine revelation and still be highly sophisticated in how you evaluate evidence in other domains.
It's not that religious people are epistemological children. It's that they have a different source code for one particular domain.
And the domain specificity is important. There's work by Deanna Kuhn showing that epistemological sophistication varies dramatically across domains within the same person. Someone can be a critical thinker about medical claims but completely credulous about political claims, or vice versa.
The compartmentalization of wisdom.
It's actually a major challenge for researchers trying to study this stuff. You can't just give someone a general epistemological questionnaire and assume it captures how they think about everything.
Let me pull on another thread from the prompt. The idea that every sentient being carries around a philosophy, even if they've never articulated it. Is there research on what happens when you ask people to articulate it? Does the act of articulation change the philosophy?
There's a whole literature on this, actually. It's called explicitation effects. When you ask people to verbalize their reasons for a belief, several things can happen. One is that the belief becomes more extreme. It's a phenomenon called thought polarization. The act of generating reasons tends to make people more confident in their position, not less.
Because you're rehearsing the arguments, not examining them.
But there's also a countervailing effect. When you ask people to explain how something works in mechanistic detail, not just why they believe it, but how the thing itself operates, they often realize they don't understand it as well as they thought. This is called the illusion of explanatory depth. It was demonstrated by researchers asking people to explain how everyday objects work, zippers, toilets, bicycles. People think they understand these things until they're asked to produce a step-by-step explanation.
Then they discover they're basically philosophical tourists in their own beliefs.
That's the illusion of explanatory depth applied to philosophy. Most people's philosophies are what you might call gist level. They have the rough outline, the emotional valence, the key conclusions. But the internal structure, the reasoning that gets from premises to conclusions, that's often surprisingly thin.
Which makes sense if Hydeed is right, that the reasoning comes after the intuition. The philosophy isn't a logical structure. It's a felt sense with some post-hoc justification draped over it.
Here's where the cultural dimension comes back in. The post-hoc justifications people reach for aren't random. They come from the cultural repertoire available to them. If you grow up in a culture that values individual autonomy, you'll justify your moral intuitions in terms of individual rights. If you grow up in a culture that values social harmony, you'll justify them in terms of obligation and duty.
Same intuition, different vocabulary.
Same intuition, different vocabulary, and over time, the vocabulary shapes the intuition. This is the co-construction argument. Culture doesn't just provide justifications. It actually shapes what you notice, what you find salient, what feels intuitive in the first place.
Which brings us back to the stability question. If your philosophy is partly a product of your cultural environment, what happens when the culture changes around you?
That's one of the most understudied questions in this field, and I think it's becoming increasingly important. There's been some work on what happens when societies undergo rapid cultural change, the fall of the Soviet Union, for instance. Researchers found that older adults who had built their meaning frameworks around Soviet ideology experienced something similar to what we see in individuals after trauma, a destabilization, a period of disorientation, and then varying degrees of reconstruction.
The philosophy equivalent of a building losing its foundation mid-earthquake.
Some people rebuilt on new ground, some tried to reconstruct the old foundation, and some never really rebuilt at all. They lived in a kind of philosophical limbo.
Is that what we're seeing now, with all the cultural churn of the last decade?
I think there's a case to be made that we're in a period of unusually rapid philosophical destabilization for a lot of people. The combination of social media, political polarization, declining institutional trust, the pandemic experience. These are all epistemically destabilizing events at a societal scale.
Which might explain why we're seeing so many people either doubling down on rigid belief systems or floating in that moratorium state you mentioned. Lots of exploration, no commitment.
The moratorium state is actually a recognized phase in identity development. The researcher James Marcia built on Erik Erikson's work and identified four identity statuses: identity achievement, where you've explored and committed; foreclosure, where you've committed without exploring; moratorium, where you're exploring but haven't committed; and diffusion, where you're neither exploring nor committing.
The four quadrants of philosophical development.
People move between them. The typical arc is from foreclosure or diffusion in adolescence, through moratorium in emerging adulthood, to achievement in established adulthood. But that's the typical arc, and plenty of people don't follow it. Some people stay in foreclosure their whole lives. Some people cycle back into moratorium after a destabilizing event.
The interesting case to me is, the person who achieves a coherent philosophy and then gets hit with something that blows it apart. What does the research say about how that reconstruction process works?
There's a concept from the grief and trauma literature called meaning reconstruction. Robert Niemeyer has written extensively about this. He argues that when people experience major loss or trauma, the primary psychological task isn't processing emotion. It's reconstructing a meaning system that can accommodate the new reality.
The wound isn't just emotional. It's philosophical.
That's Niemeyer's argument. The emotion is a signal that your meaning system has been violated, and the healing process involves revising your philosophy to make sense of what happened. Not necessarily finding a silver lining, that's too simplistic, but integrating the experience into a coherent narrative.
Which would explain why some people come out of trauma with a completely different worldview, and others just seem shattered by it. The difference might be in how effectively they reconstruct.
The reconstruction isn't always from scratch. Nehmeyer talks about meaning made, the new understanding that emerges, often being a revision of the old philosophy rather than a replacement. You keep the core, but expand it to accommodate what didn't fit before.
Like adding a wing to a house instead of tearing it down.
That's the healthier pattern, actually. The people who do best after major disruptions tend to be those who can revise their meaning systems rather than either rigidly defending the old one or abandoning it entirely for something new. It's a middle path.
Let me ask you something that's been nagging at me through this whole discussion. All this research, the developmental trajectories, the moral foundations, the narrative identity work, it's almost entirely from Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic societies. The weird samples.
The acronym is actually WERD, i.e. IRD, Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, Democratic, coined by Joe Henrich and his colleagues. And you're right, it's a massive limitation. Henrich's book, The Weirdest People in the World, makes the case that weird populations are psychological outliers on a global scale. Their moral reasoning, their self-concepts, their perceptual styles, all unusual.
When we talk about how people form philosophies, we're mostly talking about how a very specific kind of person forms a very specific kind of philosophy.
That's the uncomfortable truth. There's been some work trying to correct for this. Cross-cultural studies of moral reasoning, developmental studies in non-Western contexts. But the field is still heavily skewed. And this matters enormously for the questions in the prompt, because the whole distinction between religious and secular philosophy formation might look completely different in a society where secularism isn't even a coherent option.
Or where the very concept of having a personal philosophy is foreign. Where the philosophy is collective, not individual.
The entire framing of the prompt, every sentient being carries around their own philosophy. That's itself a culturally specific idea. It assumes an individual self that has a personal worldview. In more collectivist cultures, the relevant unit of analysis might not be the individual. The philosophy might be held by the family, the clan, the community.
Which would make the question of how it forms and changes a very different question.
And we have very little research on that. Most of the tools we use to study personal epistemology and moral reasoning were developed in weird contexts and don't translate well.
We should hold all of this lightly.
The findings are real, but their scope is narrower than we'd like to think.
Let me circle back to something you said earlier about the illusion of explanatory depth. I wonder if that applies to the researchers too. Do the people studying this stuff actually have a coherent model of how philosophy forms? Or are they mostly poking at the surface of something they don't fully understand?
That's a very corny question, and I think the honest answer is that we have pieces, useful pieces, but no unified model. The developmental psychologists have their piece. The cultural psychologists have theirs. The neuroscientists have theirs. The narrative identity researchers have theirs. But they don't fully connect.
The field itself is in moratorium. Lots of exploration, no commitment to a unified theory.
I'd say that's fair. And it might be that a unified theory isn't even possible. The process of forming a personal philosophy might be too complex, too context-dependent, too idiosyncratic to be captured by a single model.
Which is itself a philosophical position.
And that's the meta-problem, isn't it? The researchers studying philosophy formation have their own philosophies about how philosophy formation works, and those philosophies shape what they look for and what they find.
The philosopher studying philosophy formation is inside the system they're trying to study.
It's the ultimate reflexivity problem, and it's one reason I find this whole area so fascinating. You can't step outside it. You can't get a God's eye view of how people develop their views about God, meaning, purpose, truth. You're always doing it from within your own meaning system.
What do we actually know with some confidence? If you had to distill the research into a few things we can say with reasonable certainty,
I'd say we know that philosophical development follows a rough trajectory from simpler to more complex forms of reasoning, but the trajectory varies by culture and domain. We know that moral intuitions tend to precede moral reasoning. The emotional elephant leads the rational rider. We know that culture provides both the content and the scaffolding for personal philosophies, and that there appear to be sensitive periods in development where cultural influence is strongest. We know that personal philosophies tend to be stable but not fixed, with major disruptions coming from destabilizing life events and from normal developmental transitions. And we know that the process differs between religious and secular people, partly because religious communities provide institutional scaffolding that secular worldviews often lack.
That's a lot of words for it depends.
It does depend, but it depends in patterned ways, and mapping those patterns is what the research is about. The fact that the answer is complex doesn't mean we know nothing. It means the thing we're studying is genuinely complex.
One last question. You've been talking about this from the outside, as a researcher looking at subjects, but you're a person with a philosophy. How do you think yours formed?
That's a personal question. I'd say, and this is just me reflecting, not citing studies, I think my philosophy formed through a combination of the religious tradition I was raised in, the medical training that taught me to think in terms of evidence and probability, and the experience of watching patients deal with suffering and mortality. Those three threads, faith, empiricism, and the confrontation with finitude, they've been in conversation with each other for decades now, sometimes in tension, sometimes in harmony.
Has it been stable?
But I'd say my 40s were a period of re-examination. Not a crisis, exactly. More like a reorganization. Some things I'd held loosely became more central. Some things I'd held tightly. I realized I didn't need to hold so tightly. It was less like changing my philosophy, and more like understanding it better.
That tracks with what you said about midlife review. The philosophy doesn't necessarily change. You just see it more clearly.
Or you see that it was never as coherent as you thought, and you make peace with that.
I think that might be the most honest philosophical position of all. Knowing that your philosophy is a work in progress and being okay with that.
That's basically what Perry called commitment within relativism. You make your commitments, you live by them, but you know they're choices, not certainties. It's the philosophical equivalent of what Keats called negative capability, being capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason.
Which is a philosophy in itself.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, researchers studying slime mold behavior in Djibouti documented a single Fusarium polycephalum organism that extended a network of over 2,700 individual searching tendrils across a 30 square centimeter petri dish, and the entire population of slime molds observed in that study collectively produced more than 41,000 decision nodes in a single 24-hour foraging cycle.
41,000 decision nodes, and I'm told I'm slow.
The slime mold in Djibouti was apparently more decisive than you are.
I have no response to that. This has been my Weird Prompts, with thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. Until next time.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.